nearly lost my job. I told you about the revision list.
I'm not sure.
Tell you with pleasure. In about April, March 1941, there was agitation by the Jewish army in London, which came to nothing. Then, well, March, April, 40, 41. No, this began in 40, but it went on in 40, 41.
The agitation came later.
In 41. Well, when in 41? Weizmann was refused by Lloyd in 40.
Yes, but the agitation came later.
Well, what do you call agitation?
In the press.
No, I didn't mean that. Ah. Anyway, the revisionists were strongly in favor.
Oh, yes,
Jabotinsky. Obviously. Jabotinsky was dead. Jabotinsky was dead.
Yes, but his letter to Chamberlain. You know,
I'm sure.
The letter to Chamberlain.
No, I didn't know.
The day the war broke. In September, in September the 3rd, he sent a letter.
He offered help, yes.
He was in France, and he sent a very warm letter to Chamberlain.
Saying we want our legion. Like last time. The British.
To help you in general. I mean,
exactly. The British are very clear that the price last time was too high. And more than that, when I used to see telegrams during the war in the embassy, the kind of things that used to arrive from the Palestine intelligence, that the Jews are no good as soldiers, useless, and therefore, although one might make some use of them in other capacities, as fighting men, they were absolutely useless. It was very typical.
I'll tell you all about it.
All right. Now I don't know who it was. British intelligence officers.
Then
all right. Now, but the main official reason was no equipment. That's what the War Office instructed Foreign Office to say. Right. I was visited by various, since I was in charge of Jewish propaganda, Zionists were entitled to call on me. I remember a young man, his name called Adler, his name I can't remember, fiery young men who wanted tremendous Jewish air forces, legions, etc. All right. One of them was one of the Jabotinsky's people, friend of Propis. Propis I didn't meet. He was in New York. Propis was a man on whose hands Jabotinsky died. He was no Propis himself. Propis, not Mara. Propis said he was in New York with Jabotinsky in 40.
They were together in a
camp. In 40. In New York.
In New York, but it was a camp of Victor.
Well, whatever it was.
Jabotinsky didn't feel well, and Mara was there.
Mara, I'm sure, was there. And Propis. She looked after him. Anyway, this is a friend of Propis, whose name I can't remember. Who were they?
I mean, not somebody from the that later became well known, like Hillel Cook or...
Hillel Cook called him, yes. But that was a bit later. Yes.
There was certain Merlin, there was...
Merlin, someone like Merlin. Exactly like Merlin, but not Merlin.
Not Merlin.
No. Somebody's ski.
I tried...
It doesn't matter. Anyway, one of these men called him. Was he and said, could he see me? Yes. Well, I was a Zionist. He was a Zionist, that was all right. And he said, tell me this. Which is the real reason which our legion is not allowed? Is it political, in your opinion? I said, if you ask me, it certainly is political. The last time, the price was too high. When he sent this report on Clare to London, the censorship naturally intercepted it. This went to the Ministry of Information, of which I was an official. This was not the official line. The civil directive, my ex-colleague from All Souls, who was the permanent undersecretary of the Ministry of Information, an exceedingly anti-Zionist, always, said this is a very improper behavior, and perhaps it was not very quite right that I should be employed by the ministry, and perhaps it might be better if I was, instead of making propaganda to the Jews, it seemed that I was an instrument, indiscreet to them, and therefore it didn't seem very suitable for employment. I was defended. How do I know? Because I saw this after the war in the paper, well, in the... archives.
Yes, only when
the archives were opened. Yes, No, never knew it. Certainly not. No, certainly not at all. I was nearly sacked. But the man who defended me, I've forgotten his name. He was also a fellow of those, funnily enough. He was one of the leader writers of the Times.
Barrington Ward?
No. I didn't know Barrington Ward. He was used to work for various Maharajas in India, and then became, I think he worked in information too, and he was certainly on staff of the Times, before the war, maybe during the war service. He was a fellow, ex-fellow of Wolfhills. He knew me, not well. He said, you know, Mr. Berlin, that's what the file says, Mr. Berlin's position must be rather awkward. He was probably cornered by members of his faith. And there's nothing much else that he could say. Anyway, he saved me. I had no idea that my life hung on a thread. Then, about 4 months later, Israel Zeef was in America. And Israel Zeef made an extremely indiscreet speech. He was the representative, probably Minister of Supply or something like that, I mean, sent to America. That capacity, and made friends with various important Americans afterwards, or part of the, in Washington and so on. Quite useful. Yeah, I think he was one of them for a good part of the war. He made a speech in Buffalo or Schenectady or some upstate New York, reported in the papers, saying that the exchange of populations with the Arabs ought to occur. That was the way to make Palestine Jewish. The Arabs should be removed and Jews should be put in. Well-known idea. Well, it was not the idea of His Majesty's government,
yes,
under the white paper.
Now, I have to tell you about the ideas of transfer. You know that in 1944, in the labor...
Let me finish my story.
Sorry.
The result was that a telegram arrived from the Ministry of, from the Foreign Office, repeated, Ministry of Information, anyone who knows Mr. Zeef ought to inform him that he ought to return to England forthwith. This speech completely compromises his position, etc. I mean, it wasn't my business to, I telephoned him. I told him that he was in some difficulty, that if he wanted to stay, he'd better talk with the embassy and clear himself as best he could. And I sent off a telegram of my own saying that I'd read this in the papers, that I knew that he was somewhat impulsive man, that he very greatly regretted it, and that his services as a British economic agent, probably, but probably greater than the discussion report in the press. But, of course, I left it to them aside. He was not taken, not made to return, but he very nearly was.
Well,
right. Of course, rightly, yes. I'll tell you, that was the time when people like, who was that famous revisionist, film, right, Ben Hecht made his famous statement saying, every time a British soldier is killed, in 1947, that's right, when he was already talking, violent anti-British talk, I met him. And he said, anything he could do against Britain, he would.
After 41.
Well, the white paper.
You see, but, yes.
The attitude of the Zionists on the part of the British Embassy was embarrassing her eyes. They wished them not to be there. On the whole, they thought they were to get her out of the way. They were officially, they received them, but unofficially, they wished they were gone.
It's very good, the definition, embarrassing her eyes. Certainly.
Yeah. Now tell me about...
The transfer.
Yes.
You see, the idea of transfer was very current among British political elite, labor, in the war, not only as regards Palestine. I mean, Lord Moyne, for example, produced in 1944 internal memorandum saying that it was in 1941 that after the war we should certainly clear Silesia and the Sudeten from the Germans and let the displaced Jews go there, for example. I published a document, by the way.
Very idiotic.
Huh?
Idiotic.
I'll keep...
I'll tell you some more.
And Emery was toying with the idea of transfer in Palestine in 41 too. And
Emery.
Now, Dalton came with it in 44. You see,
what did Dalton do?
Dalton was Minister of Economic Warfare, but in 44, he was brought it to the Labour Conference, to the open...
What the idea of transfer?
Transfer of the Arabs.
Of the Arabs, yes. Not to Silesia.
No. That was in Palestine. Emery also was in Palestine. But the point is that...
Let me tell you more. Yeah. There was a letter in the Foreign Office filed somewhere by Lord Bestwood of that time, who was, of course, anti-Zionist, who said the best thing to do for the Jews would be to remove the Germans from Bavaria and plant entirely the Jews.
Bestwood was anti-Zionist,
but
he was a counselor to the Jewish agency in St. James in 1939.
No. Bestwood was not. Early was. Reading's son.
Reading's son was, I know. But I thought that it was...
Maybe, but they secretly... I'll tell you a story about Bestwood. It has nothing to do with us. Let's leave it there. The record. He is the father of the present Lord Bestwood. He just died, did he? I can't remember. I don't know if his son died or not, but this was the one who was certainly dead in the 40s. Second Lord or First Lord, I mean. He wrote a letter to the, or made it to the Jockey Club. No. The Turf Club, which he wanted to be a member. Saying if they made him a member, he would contribute £1,000 and he would promise never to go there. They replied quite, the head of the said, of course, he said, if he hadn't offered the money and said he wouldn't go, he might have been made a member. After that, it was impossible. The whole story. Go to the table. Just show.
Now, going back to New York, your other activities and contacts were either minorities.
Yep.
Catholics, Irish, Italian, Polish. Where was the organization?
Not Irish, no. Catholics as such. Mormons. Yes. The Zion's Herald, I used to correspond with. The Mormons and dissident Mormons in Colorado who broke away from the Mormons in Utah.
Now, they were probably of importance, otherwise you wouldn't have wasted your time.
Everybody's importance. The idea was that everybody who could be, so to speak.
Did
you
decide or did you get directives?
No, I think I was left fairly free. But I knew that my business was to leave out the Episcopalians Presbyterians, Baptists, the Protestants, and concentrate on Catholics, Jews, and other unfashionable.
None of you. Now, was there something interesting in this field that, were there circles that were of interest to you?
No, I used to meet, occasionally used to meet editors of liberal Catholic papers in New York, who on the whole were pretty decent people. There was a very good Jesuit paper, whose name I can't remember. What was it called? Commonwealth, I think. What could it be, or America, I can't remember. Chief Jesuit paper in New York, very liberal. Well, I used to see Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr, and people like that, you can imagine. Natural friends of the British, and of the Jews.
And universities were in your...
No.
Were they at all, did anybody else go to
this? Yes, there were groups. There were... pro-British groups, some universities. They communicated with, I don't know whom, probably with, for example, Charles Webster, when he was head of the British Information Office. Probably he used to go up to Harvard and see his old pupils, like John Fairbank. I don't think there may have been contacts.
They were probably
the Boston Consul. That's right, Consul General, I think so. I had nothing to do with it.
Were you invited to speak in campuses?
Never.
Never?
I wasn't known to exist. No. Nobody thought of me as academic in that sense.
And later, when you were in Washington?
No, then.
But when you were in Washington, you knew there some philosophers, or you know, actually, I think, many philosophers.
No, far from it. The only philosopher I knew was Quine. He worked in the Navy Department. And him I used to meet once in 2 months, 3 months, and he used to chat about philosophy.
There was no problem going to persuade him about the war, or the war, he was
in the government. He was in the government.
And in New England?
No. I don't think he'd ever been here. Been to Vienna. He'd been to Vienna. Vienna. Yes. Carnap and Wittgenstein. Yes. Not in England. No. Freddie Eyre was there, in the intelligence. It's 3 years, I mean.
Are you in Washington?
No, New York. New York had a combination of SIS and SOE. Yes. The only place where they were together, yes, under Stevens. Yes. And he was there, and another, not called Hyatt, was there, and Bill Deakin was there.
Did Bill go to New York?
Absolutely, yeah. I used to see him there.
So he went to Cairo later?
He went to Cairo later. From New York. He was in New York at the time of Pearl Harbor. End of 41. And he did quite a lot of work in that office. I used to see him quite, when I was in New York, quite a lot.
You were Freddie or Bill?
Bill and Freddie. Together, great friends. Who we used to meet. He was quite amusing, Bill, about his work. There was people like a Lithuanian bishop who was suspected of being a Nazi agent, was arrested in the end by the Americans, but in his bag, when they looked for it, was nothing but pornography. It was called Archbishop Bushko, some kind of Ukrainian uniat, or something like that. Father Bushko. Those kind of stories circulated quite a lot.
Pardon?
Those kind of stories.
Yes, I'm sure.
And that's when I met Halperin. who was a British agent. The neck was Alexander Alpen. Interesting man, who I made friends with. Alpen belonged to a Russian Jewish family, one of the six or seven families who were members of the gentry. They were not barons like Ginsburg, that was unique, but they were Dvoriani, that is, they were members of the official gentry, were Jews or not. The highest Jews could get to under that was being the very rich Jews who made hereditary honorary citizens, which was done for merchants, but not for gentlemen. That was my great-grandfather. And therefore, by inheritance, my grandfather, my father, myself, in Riga, yes. We didn't have trouble about living anymore.
You mean you inherited the status?
Yes. It was a very... It wasn't a noble status. It was given to rich merchants.
But it's
worth... It's called hereditary. That's why it's inherited. Hereditary honorary citizen. And that meant that you could enjoy certain privileges. The police couldn't arrest you. Would live where you liked. You could do what you liked. Perfectly easy. Like any Russian merchant. Wherever you wished. You see? And that is because my pseudo-great-grandfather was a very rich man. Must have contributed to charity. That's how Ginsburg also got his title in the end. But anyway, he got it. Now, Alpen was better than that. His father was an eminent lawyer who used to plead cases before the Senate, things like that. Galpen. The one or two other people were Jewish judges in Russia. One or two there were.
Judges?
Yes. One or two. Nothing very much. There was a man called Title. T-I-T-L. Who was a judge? But there's an exception. Now, the great leader of the Liberal Party, for example, Vinaver. Vinaver with Milyukov was the head of the cadets. He was not a hereditary citizen. He was not the Dvorianin. They just wanted to Jew for these purposes. So it's not common. Now, Alpen was the lawyer. His father and he were lawyers to the British Embassy. He was left-wing. He didn't know if he was a Bolshevik, but he was certainly a socialist. And knew other socialists mixed in their circles. And in 1917, he became the assistant secretary of the provisional government. The secretary was a man called Nabokov. He was his deputy. Nabokov was once described by Trotsky in his book as a starched Anglophile. Nabokov resigned for some reason, for he didn't agree with some policy, and Alpen succeeded him. And his assistant was a man called Mark Wolf, who died about 3 months ago in London, aged 94, who I knew very well, international lawyer. Very nice man. These were the Petersburg Jews. Alexander Yakovlevich Galpin, his father was Yakov. In 1917, when the New Kerensk killed all these people very well, in 1917 when the Bolsheviks came in, when the naval attaché of the British Embassy was assassinated by Bolsheviks, probably Bolshevik sailors, on the steps of the British Embassy, I think, Alpen decided that as a lawyer of the British Embassy, life was not very secure for him, and he escaped. His father might have died by then, came to London, set up as an international lawyer, with Wolf as his partner. What he did then, I don't know. I met him in 1941. But the point was that he was probably did a bit British intelligence. I can't believe they didn't. But he went probably in London too. He was rather snob. He was a man of great charm. He mingled in my white Russian circles, but he was also tremendously to do with art, which was a Jewish thing. He became always chairman of art in London.
Ah, yes, of course. He was a chairman for many years.
For many years.
Until...
after the war.
Even later, after the 60s.
Whenever you like.
I know the name.
Yes, exactly.
I think Aline knew him most of
all. Well, she knew because I knew him. She knew because I knew him. Wait, wait.
She knew it through you.
Because we gave him his... We give, because Aline's husband, before me, gave his house and didn't charge rent. Oh, yes, well, anyway, he was in New York in 41. I was introduced to him by Historic. Historic was the head of the Jewish Colonial Trust. Russian Jew? Historic. What? No. No. He was a Malamed in Moscow. But he became at the head of the Jewish Zionist Bank, and Mrs. Weizmann called him Montague Norman. He was always boasted about his contacts with important British bankers. He was not Leon, no. Another awful son called Eric, Esterik, with an E. Historic means historian in Russian. He knew me, I don't know, from London or something, must have met me in Zionist circles. Anyway, he telephoned me and said, "There's an interesting man. I'd like you to meet him. I'm sure you'll be friends." So I was introduced to Alpin. By that time, Alpin was married to a Georgian princess who was the knew all the poets of Petersburg in 1910. Mandelstam was in love with her. She knew Stravinsky. She knew his wife. She was a famous hostess, a beautiful lady. And she married him in the 20s. And she was with him in New York. And so I used to visit them. Officially he came for art. But in fact, he was in Bill Deakin's office. And Bill Deakin knew him intimately. And he was always called the Presidente, because he was thought to look like a president of Latin American Republic. He was a highly intelligent man. We knew a lot about the Slavs. I didn't know what he did. But he was paid for, quite officially, part of that Stevenson office. But he moved to the left as the war went on. And his wife was always rather leftish. When they came back to London, they practically became fellow travelers. Yes. All Soviet writers could call on them without letter hindrance, particularly after he died. While he was there, he was a Jew, and that wasn't slightly against him. But after he died, I made the estate in the Gilders Green crematorium I had to. He was an interesting man, highly civilized, with great charm, old-fashioned, and highly educated, cultivated, interesting Russian Jew. Tremendous gentleman.
Such a Jew, his second language would be French or German or English?
His language was English. He could speak French absolutely freely. Completely freely.
And
German, I'm not so sure.
Did he have Jewish
guys
at all?
What?
Did he have some Jewish guys? Did he know about...
Well, Lord, he knew who the Jews were.
Oh,
okay. You mean, he knew the Bellow family. He knew all these people. Not much of a Jew. No. He knew a few words, perhaps.
And when you meet such a man during the war, I mean, did political Jewish problem arise?
Never. I thought it was no good. He didn't take faintest interest. He was a tremendous Anglo snob. The people he knew were English bankers, and he moved like moving in their circles. For these purposes, he was a kind of distinguished white Russian.
And yet such a man moves to the left to the extent that he...
Well, Wolf became secretary of the Humanitarian Trust, which was founded by Pollack, which sends all its money to Israel. He was more Jewish, the partner.
The Humanitarian Trust was founded by Pollack.
Founded by Pollack in England. He was strictly, and then taken over by his nephew, Michael Ginsburg. And Pollack was ferociously anti-Zionist. He was in Haifa, made a lot of money, but he wouldn't contribute to a single Zionist organization. Weizmann used to be very useful to Israel or to Palestine, but didn't hold with Jewish state or anything of that sort. But when Weizmann used to ask for money, he would say in Russian, "We are villagers, you know, we are ignorant people, we're illiterates, we don't know about that kind of thing."
And so what were the aims of the Humanitarian Trust?
It was set up in London to spend money on whatever they wanted, by him, by a lawyer called Edelson, who was even more anti-Zionist than he was. Ginsburg was not anti-Zionist, the nephew. The nephew inherited it from the uncle and made me a member of it. And he, the heirs of Pollack, contested it. Contested the entire inheritance. Ginsburg became very rich, because Pollack became a millionaire. The money was in Rothschilds. Ginsburg lived in Paris and Switzerland. And he died, and in turn his nephew inherited his money, and he and Jacob Rothschild and I are the trustees of the Marian Trust, which is not big, and it sends 80% of what it does to Israel. The money was made in Israel.
In Palestine?
Palestine. Pollack died before the war.
The cement.
Nesher.
But he made his real money, I think, from the oil of Baku.
Yes, but he didn't have much left. He was a Rothschild agent in Baku. But I think when he left Russia, well, he went to see my father-in-law. He went to see Ginsburg, my Aline's father, because he knew who did the... And when he went to see the Baron Edmond, he said, "You know, I have no money left. I'm totally ruined. I've absolutely nothing. I left Russia with no money. I have no money whatever." And Edmond said to him, "You have quite a lot of money in the bank," and gave it to him. Simply. Elegant gesture. "No, no, this is not true," he said. "You have money in the bank. I can tell you how much." It's on that Nesher was founded. Indirectly, Edmond, again. Elegant gesture. He was his name, yeah?
Again, in one of the previous meetings...
He said, "I'm a completely poor man." And then Mo said, "You're not." Something like that. "You're mistaken."
Now, who put you in the committee? Halperin or of the Humanitarian Trust?
Halperin had nothing to do with it.
Sorry,
Ginsburg? He was called, what is his name?
He's not related to Aline.
No.
No, entirely.
He and American Yevnin were the trustees. Who is a Russian Jew?
Yes.
And he and Ginsburg served in the same Russian regiment before the war. That is the connection. And what was Ginsburg's name? I've forgotten. Yes. Some Russian.
I mean, one of those Russians who left Russia after...
Yes.
And went to England.
He went to, I think, Paris probably. But his money was in England. He never did any business. He was just a very rich man. He may have worked for his uncle, for Pollack, but he said he didn't what he did. He lived in England, yes. His wife died, and he inherited, he adopted his nephew. He didn't get children of his own. I think he was called Matvey, Matthew Ginsburg. Matvey, his nephew.
Matityahu. Matvey.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your ties with the Hebrew University.
Well, they were not there. I was made a member of the Friends of the University by Bentwich.
1934.
Yes. I sat, as I described in a book, on the committee to appoint a professor in English literature and institutions. The other members of the committee were Bentwich, Nehmia, and Adams, who was then the secretary of the London School of Economics, and a member, chief organizer of the Committee of Refugees, called German Refugees. So he was very pro kind of thing. Bentwich worked with him on getting academic refugees. It's called Refugee Assistance Council, Academic Assistance Council.
Getting them out of Germany and
getting them to England.
England.
Yeah. Combrich, etc. All these things. Klaus Moser. It's all done that way. Not Moser, because his father was a businessman, I think. But everybody who came in. And, we had candidates who were lecturers in English, Jewish lecturers in English universities. Not very many. Nehmia sat down. We had no German, just four of us. And they would glare at these people and say, Mr. Levy. After we took the ordinary details, your age, your occupation, your university, your prospects, why do you want to come, etc. We'd say, Mr. I tell the story in my life of Nehmia, my article Nehmia. Mr. Levy, can you shoot? Mr. Levy would say, no, I don't think so. Because if you go to Palestine, you will have to learn to shoot. Because if you do not shoot our Arab cousins, they will shoot you. Etc. Every single candidate withdrew. No appointment was made. The man who became it was somebody, I couldn't his name, you probably remember, there was a man. Mendelow.
Ah, yes, that's when you appointed Mendelow.
We didn't. I tell you what happened.
Ah.
Nothing to do with us.
When he went to India. And
nothing to do with us.
And then he was appointed after for.
You know, it's very likely. I have no idea what happened. Anyhow, yeah, that was the job to which we failed to appoint literature and institutions at that time. Strange thing, probably to literature.
Yeah.
I never met him. I knew nothing about him. Anyhow, that's what, how I became associated with the university. Then I went. When I went to Israel in 1934, I did not meet Mangus, nor did I particularly wish to. Who did I meet? Several people. Leon Roth, of course, whom I knew more or less from England. He introduced me, took me to dinner with Shmari Levin, where there was Sholem. And, let me see who else. I don't remember now. One or two people at the university, Fekete, who taught mathematics. The great mathematician, what's his name?
Frankl.
I met then.
There were not many.
I didn't meet Saborsky then, no. I just met him casually, like that. I did not meet the professor of philosophy, what's his name? the chief on...
Who was the chief?
Bergman.
Ah, Bergman,
yes. You see, I met after the audit. Who else could I have met? I remember meeting... I'll tell you who. Bennett, who was an Orientalist, and who was not sure if he had a library or not.
Possibly. I mean, Bergman was the first, and then Bennett.
Could be. I met Reifenberg, because he married Miss Lubavitch, who was, of course, related, a friend of my aunt. All the Lubavitches to come to Riga. They're all friends of my family. A very close link. They all came to Riga. They're called Leibovich because that's the German translation. In Russia, we call them in Riga, Lubavitch.
Yes, she's a Leibovich, I know.
Certainly. Where's Esther Reitenberg? Is she alive?
Yes.
He tells me that marvelous story about Einstein and I've never forgotten, about Einstein and, what's his name, it doesn't matter his name, I got my name immediately, the president of the U.S.
The president of the Hebrew
Yes.
You don't mean Magnus.
Yes, I do. There was a meeting of the Friends of the Hebrew University in about 1929. Einstein was a friend. And there was a meeting. In the course of the meeting, and Reifenberg was there. Magnus said, in view of the very generous contributions of the American Friends, might the number of trustees or members of the council activities of the Friends of the University be increased? To which Einstein said, Professor Magnus, I'm terribly sorry. I'm afraid I'm getting rather deaf. It's a great obstacle to me. Sometimes I don't quite hear what people say. And if I may have got you wrong, if so, I wish to apologize in advance. I hope you will not hold it against me. Did I understand you to say that if the contributions of our American friends decrease, the number of American governors should be cut? After that, Magnus did not return to the subject. It's quite a funny story.
Now, then you were actually...
Not friends, I mean governors at this point.
In this period he was active, Einstein.
I'm sure.
Now, until 39, were you involved in any other activity concerning the university in England? I mean, committees, academic appointments.
Were you the Hebrew University? No.
Now, who was else active? I mean, there were other probably.
I have no idea. I'll tell you. For example, the man made the report on the university, whom and whose wife I knew.
Yeah.
What's his name? There was a report on the university in the 30s. There was Radcliffe Salomon, for example. Radcliffe Salomon. He was on that committee. Hartog. There was a Hartog report. Sir Philip Hartog. I knew him. But he was appointed to a kind of search committee. I mean, not such a kind of visiting committee, to make a report. It was quite tough. You see, Hartog Salomon, Hitler Salomon, who was president, said he knew about potatoes. It's a great book. It's called The Potato. He was a brother, son of Mechutin, of Herbert Samuel. His daughter married, you know, his son married Samuel's daughter. Then let me see. I had nothing to do with any of this.
1939, I see.
I used to go to meetings of the Friends. Yes. And there I used to meet people like Hartog, who talked to me.
Where together, are there also Don's friends in the university before 39?
I have no idea. I should think it highly unlikely. I should think it highly unlikely that anybody in Oxford or Cambridge had the faintest connection. I may be wrong, but the number of Jews in Oxford was very minute, and the number of Goyim, Gentiles who took an interest in Jerusalem, I knew of nobody.
Now, the number of Jews was still very minute.
Very minute, I wouldn't say, but number of undergraduates, I can't tell you how many.
No,
probably Dons. There were German refugees. But that was a special class. Mainly scientists. But there were some interesting historians. Jacobi, Jakob Stahl, Frankl. There was an economist called Marshak. There was Cassira for a short time, and philosophers, short time, yes. There, among scientists, there was Klibanski for a short time. He's back here now. Become a fellow wolves. Some kind of special position is. There's, comes every summer. There were Simon, who was a famous physicist, Christchurch. There was Kuhn. There were people still about. I can mention six or seven among the refugees. But if you were talking about English Jew, I mean normal people, not Germans. There were no fellows of college except me.
You were the first?
No, I was not.
In all sorts you were the first?
Yes. Very much so. And remained one until after war. After me, the next one was Joseph, Keith Joseph. Then again, nobody. For a long time. I'm trying to think who were the Jewish teachers. There was a man called Lipson, who was not a fellow and not a lecturer, who taught economic history. People used to have to go, his house in North Oxford, he was kind of Melamed, I mean, he had no real position. He made, Herbert Lowy, who was Hebrew studies, was a member of Common Room in Exeter. Cecil Roth was not a fellow of anyone, but he had a member of Common Room in Merton. Ettinghausen was a lecturer in Queens, but not a fellow. German. I'm trying to think. May have been others unknown to me.
In your college, in your time, nobody.
In my time, certainly not. No. In all sorts, not. Corpus Christi, certainly not. Who could that be? Goodhart was. He became a professor of jurisprudence in 31. Yes. He very much not a Jew. He wasn't anxious. He became one as a result of Hitler. His wife wasn't, and his sons aren't. Member of Parliament now, so nothing to do with Jews. All Church of England. And so brought up. But he was one. Cousin of Morgenthau, cousin of Lehmann, what could he do? But nobody didn't. There wasn't ever referred to as one. Belonged to no Jewish organization known to me before the war.
When was Max Beloff elected?
Max Beloff was prize fellow for a year or two in Corpus. During the war, he was a lecturer in Manchester. He did become a fellow of Nuffield, not long after the war. But no, not before the war. Prize fellow maybe, for 3 years. I think Deichs was a prize fellow of Belo. That meant 2 years, 3 years. That happened. Yes, that happened. Jews couldn't become so temporary fellows. They had no tutors. Fellow and tutor was the basic office. No lecturer. That means you may even one or two others.
So the main breakthrough came in the 50s.
Yes. Certainly not before that. I think that's right. I'm trying to think who then became fellows. I think lots of people. A man called Bueno de Mesquita in Christchurch, a man called Lewis in Christchurch. Who was the first Jewish fellow of all those after Joseph?
When did Dauber come to
Plato? But Dauber came in the